Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. At the beginning of this year, enthusiasm to vote in the 2020 presidential election was surging, and so were new voter registrations. Then the COVID-19 pandemic hit, and the number of new registrations fell off a cliff. That's what two of my colleagues here at 538 found after analyzing the data in states where new voter registration numbers are available. So we're going to take a look at what happened and what this all means for the fall, and we're also going to explore some of the challenges that primary voters have faced while trying to cast ballots during the pandemic this spring. And here with me to do that are elections analyst Nathaniel Rakich. Hey, Nathaniel.
Hey, Galen.
And also with us is tech and politics reporter Kaylee Rogers. Hey, Kaylee.
Hey.
So before we get into some of the challenges with actual voting, let's talk about these new voter registrations, because, of course, a presidential year is usually a big time for signing up new voters, people who turn 18, etc. So can you describe some of the numbers behind the trend that I described, that significant drop off in new registered voters, Kaylee?
We saw in a number of states, we looked at 11 states plus DC, just because those were the ones where the data was available. And we saw the same pattern every time, where in January and February, compared to 2016, new voter registrations were actually up. And then the pandemic hit, everything kind of gets shut down, and everything drops significantly. So we can look at Florida, for example. In February of this year, there was over 100,000 new voters registered, and that's compared to around 87,000 in February of 2016. Then you go to April, and only 21,031 new voters registered, compared to about 52,000 in 2016. So you can see, like, the difference is significant. We expected that the number of new voters would be higher than in 2016, both due to population growth, but also just because of all the enthusiasm about this election. And instead, we've seen a major drop off because of COVID.
Yeah, the drop off when you look at all the states together is really stark. So, for example, there were 192,986 more new registrants in January 2020 than in January 2016. And there were 93,249 more registrants in February 2020 than in February 2016. But then in March, there were 141,381 fewer registrants in 2020 than in 2016. And in April, which of course was the first full month of the pandemic, new voter registrations were down 474,938 in these 12 places.
That's a pretty significant drop off. I mean, I think we can guess at some of the reasons this happened, like people aren't going to the DMV anymore. But paint a picture of the different factors at play in why voter registrations fell off a cliff.
So it's a number of things kind of combined. If you think about what was shut down with social distancing and quarantine, it's basically all the ways that people register to vote. So like you mentioned, the DMV, any kind of public government office that doesn't have to be open. In many states, they were closed down. And then just public events like fairs and festivals and high schools, graduation ceremonies, new citizen ceremonies, all these places where third party groups, for example, would normally try to sign up new voters, all of that shut down. So we're left with a few states where you have online registration or mail-in registration, and that's pretty much it.
And did online and mail-in registration hold up, or is this also a story of like people were just occupied by other things, and even the places where people can sign up to vote or register to vote that don't involve being in person also suffered?
No, those places didn't suffer as much. It varies depending on the state you're looking at. So remote forms of registration, i.e. online registration, did go up in some states. It did go down in some states, but overall it remained pretty more or less steady. And that's compared to these big drops in the in-person methods like the DMV that we saw. Our article that's on the site has some great graphics by Elena, one of our visual journalists, on this. So people should check it out. But even in the places where online registration increased, for example, Washington, D.C., I think is the most prominent example. That's actually not unusual. In 2016, online registration also increased over the course of the spring because D.C. holds its primary in June. So there's usually a spike in registrations before primaries anyway. So basically the story is that a lot fewer people are registering via these in-person methods, and it's not like they're actively turning toward, oh, I should go register online now. It's that those new registrations aren't showing up in the voter rolls.
Well, and online registrations aren't even available in every state, right?
Right. So 39 states plus Washington, D.C. offer online voter registration, although Oklahoma will become the 40th soon. So that is most states, in fairness. And you can also register by mail in the states that don't allow online registration, although obviously that's a lot more cumbersome.
I also spoke with Wendy Weiser from the Brennan Center at NYU, and she mentioned that part of the reason for this might be because when you're at the DMV, it's a really sort of active process. You're there already, probably because you have to be, and then someone is prompting you to get added to the voter rolls. That's different than taking your own time proactively to go online, figure out how to register, or maybe even have to do it by mail, print off something, fill it out, send it in. I mean, who has stamps? It's just like, it's much more cumbersome to proactively go do it yourself than to be than to be prompted by somebody in a scenario where you're already doing something you have to do.
This is, I assume, a big deal for civics groups like the League of Women Voters and so on that spend these election years, like you said, setting up tables outside of fairs, graduations, signing up new voters. Are they taking any measures to try to make up for it? Are they able to get back out in public now that some states are opening up? Like, how do we expect the response to this major dip in new registrations to go?
Right. So it sort of depends on the group. League of Women Voters, I spoke to one of the directors there, and she said that they've really been hit hard. You know, they typically go to new citizen ceremonies and high schools. Those are like their big drives that they do. And so both of those were taken off the table. She said they had something like 850 high school graduations they planned to go to this spring, and all of them were canceled. So they've really been struggling. They're trying to turn to more online messaging, directing people to how to do it themselves. But she said it's really going to be hard for third-party groups to make up the difference on their own. I also spoke to someone from Voto Latino, which has been largely an online-first group from the beginning. So they haven't had as much trouble. And they've said that actually they've seen their numbers go up higher than they expected as people have become kind of more civically engaged, especially with the protests happening.
Yeah, I mean, now that states have started to open back up, Nathaniel, have we seen any trend back towards either what we were seeing in 2016 or even more as we saw in January and February?
We just don't have the data yet. Even the May registration data isn't available in a lot of states, and no states have the June registration data available, which I think is when that would start to show up. But there was no sign of any kind of recovery in the voter registration numbers in May in any of the states for which we have that data.
I think that there's a chance that we might not ever get all of the voters that we would have got had we not had a pandemic. It's really hard to predict, obviously, but we have some cases that are we can look at. So in Florida, for example, in 2011, they passed a law that made it really difficult for third-party groups to run their registrations in the state, and a lot of those groups just stopped operating in Florida altogether. And in 2012, in spring of that year, they ended up sort of overturning that rule. But by the time the election came around in 2012, the difference had not really been made up. So in 2008, more than 1 million new voters registered in Florida. And in 2012, fewer than 900,000 did. So that's a gap of about 100,000 people, at least, that were potentially lost just from this law preventing third-party groups from operating the way they normally would. So when we have something that's more widespread, like a pandemic, you can imagine that it might have some lingering effects, although we obviously won't know till this is all over.
Yeah, exactly. I think the million-dollar question is, are these quote-unquote lost registrations actually lost, or are they just delayed? And I think that the Florida example shows that a lot of them may actually be lost for good. You know, the question is, do people proactively decide, hey, there's an election coming up, I should register to vote, or do they just do it out of opportunity? For example, they're renewing their driver's license in, you know, April of the election year, and they sign up. And, you know, I suppose people who are renewing their driver's license will eventually go back to the DMV to get the transaction done. But I think, you know, in a lot of cases, it's just chance. Somebody asks you, do you want to register to vote today? And people say, sure, why not? Rather than actively doing so. I think if people were more actively seeking out voter registration opportunities, they would be registering online, which we're seeing has not increased a ton.
And of course, the other big question here for elections watchers is going to be, is there a partisan effect associated with these lost or delayed registrants, right? As we discussed, when you think of things like graduations or people turning 18, we're talking about new young voters. And we know from looking at the polls that those people skew heavily towards the Democratic Party, even if they don't see themselves as Democrats, they're more progressive or liberal. You know, can we look at this data now and say that, oh, this is bad for Democrats, or is it just too early?
demographic data is pretty hard to come by. It's already, you know, as Kaylee mentioned, there are only 12 places that have data on new registrants at all, and demographic breakdowns are even rarer to come by. But one thing that does seem to be consistently true is that new registrants tend to be younger. So we spoke with Kevin Morris at the Brennan Center, who kindly sent us some data that found that 57% of new registrants in January through April 2016, so 4 years ago, were under the age of 40. In Georgia, that number was 65% under 40 years old. You know, and of course, this isn't surprising because most people who are newly registering are going to be people who are newly eligible to vote. You know, and turning 18 is kind of one of the main ways that people become eligible to vote. We will say that partisan-wise, obviously some states register by party, and there wasn't like a consistent pattern of new registrants being disproportionately Democratic or Republican. They did disproportionately tend to be unaffiliated with either party. Now, that's kind of an inconclusive finding because unaffiliated voters don't necessarily mean they're swing voters. It could just be that people don't like to publicly associate with a party. We know, for example, that a lot of young voters are just choosing not to identify with a party. So, of course, the fact that they're unaffiliated and young is probably related. But as you mentioned, Galen, you know, younger voters do tend to vote Democratic. So if I had to say that one party was disadvantaged from this, I would say it's Democrats. But I do think it's too early to tell, not least because we don't know whether these people are eventually going to register or not.
One question I have here, just looking at the data that you had access to, is like, why only 11 states plus DC? Why isn't every state publishing their voter registration data?
Good question, Galen. States, please publish new voter registration data. Now, I will say that every state does have data on the total number of registered voters, and you can kind of infer from the changes month to month or quarter to quarter how many new people are registering, but that's a net change. So it, you know, would be all the new registrants minus all the people who are purged or who move and things like that. And we were specifically looking at new registrants. So only 11 states plus Washington, D.C. had that data as far as we could tell.
All right, so we will keep tracking this and see if voter registrations as states are reopening, et cetera, tick back up. But let's move on and talk about some of the challenges, not with registering, but actually voting this spring in primary elections. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Lightstream. Are you tired of credit card bills with high interest rates? Ready to pay off your credit card balances and start saving money? Get a credit card consolidation loan from Lightstream and you could save thousands in interest. And get a rate as low as 5.95% APR with autopay and excellent credit. That's lower than the average credit card interest rate of over 19% APR. The rate is fixed, so it will never go up over the life of the loan. Plus, there are absolutely no fees. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Apply today to get a special interest rate discount and save even more. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. We're back, and this spring, we've had the opportunity to see what voting looks like during a pandemic. The elections have been primaries by and large, so turnout has been significantly lower than it would be in a general election. But nonetheless, we've seen election day after election day where voters say they haven't received the mail ballots that they requested. We've also seen lines of voters waiting for hours after polling locations have been consolidated. So what is going on here? And are we ready for a fall election that will see much higher turnout? So we're going to get to some of the examples dating back to, say, March. But because there was a primary this week, let's talk about what happened in the competitive races in New York and Kentucky. What did voting look like? Was it better than some of the other places we've seen, or were there, again, long lines and people not receiving the ballots they requested?
every state has success stories and some not so success stories, and New York and Kentucky were no different. So, for example, Kentucky infamously consolidated down to just one in-person polling place for many counties, including large ones like where the cities of Louisville and Lexington are located. And a lot of people predicted this would lead to long lines. And in Louisville, there were no long lines, and in Lexington, there were. So again, kind of hit or miss. In New York, I saw some scattered reports of lines. I also heard of a lot of people who were not getting their absentee ballots that they had requested. But look, this has largely become par for the course, unfortunately, for primary elections during the pandemic. You see the same things happening over and over again, which are a lot of people apply for absentee ballots for obvious reasons. This overloads the system that most states have because they're just not used to getting that kind of volume of absentee requests. As a result, absentee ballots take a long time to get mailed out. In many cases, they get lost, their requests get lost, and the ballots don't get mailed at all. At the same time, for the in-person polling places, poll workers are dropping out because they're afraid of catching COVID-19. As a result, polling places have to be consolidated, and as a result, lines form. And this, of course, is exacerbated by the people who didn't receive their absentee ballots going to vote in person, which leads to higher than expected in-person voting volumes. So this has been true in, I would say, most states that have held their primaries, you know, going back all the way to Wisconsin, which I'm sure a lot of listeners remember, but also states like Maryland, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Kentucky, and New York have all experienced these similar problems. So, you know, it seems like we know what the problems are, and hopefully states are observing that and taking steps for the general election. But it's a concern for sure.
I will say, just anecdotally, a number of my friends here in New York applied for absentee ballots to try to avoid having to go to the polls in person, didn't receive them in time, and ended up having to go vote in person. Or a couple of them actually got them, but kind of at the last minute. They actually received them on Tuesday, and they felt like there wasn't enough time. They didn't trust that they would be able to return it with enough time for it to count, and ended up going to the polls anyway. So there's a number of ways that this can kind of break down.
Yeah. Are we able to judge at all how widespread of a problem people not receiving mail-in ballots is, or do we have to just rely on the anecdotes?
No, unfortunately, you know, it's just very hard to measure a negative, like how many people don't receive their ballots. So there isn't good data for this question, especially on a statewide level. I do have a few pieces of anecdata that I think are informative. So in the Ohio primary, six counties around Dayton, Ohio, said that about 4,500 people who requested an absentee ballot weren't mailed one because their request forms lacked essential information. In addition, in Delaware County, Pennsylvania, officials admitted that they just ran out of time to send out ballots to people who requested them. They said that 400 requests simply went unfulfilled. And then another 6,000 ballots they sent out the day before the election, which basically, kind of as Kaylee was alluding to, doesn't leave any time to for the voters to actually vote them. So those ballots, even if the people got them, were probably unvotable. So if you extrapolate these numbers from just individual counties, albeit fairly large counties, but if you extrapolate that out to a statewide level, it seems likely that tens of thousands of people in these two states at least didn't receive their absentee ballots in time to vote.
And are we able to then look at the overall data and see whether or not turnout is down as a result? What does turnout look like during this primary season?
That's a great question, and it's kind of all over the map. So Kentucky looks like it's going to have record or near record turnout. The current estimate is that more than a million people voted in the Kentucky primary, which would be about a 30% turnout rate of the eligible population. This is right on par with the 2008 turnout rate, which was 29%, and it's significantly higher than the 2016 turnout rate, which was 21%. And that's pretty remarkable, too, because in Kentucky in 2016, both the Republican and Democrat primaries were competitive. And of course, this year, neither one was. I should say presidential primaries. They did have a major Senate primary in Kentucky, of course. But that is pretty remarkable and may have had something to do with the fact that Kentucky made it easier to vote absentee overall, because even if some people didn't get their ballots on time, although I haven't heard of things going badly in that way in Kentucky. Kentucky normally requires an excuse to vote absentee, and they waived that excuse this time, so it was just a lot easier to vote a mail ballot. I will say, though, in some other states, turnout was down. from 2016. And again, that could be due to a number of factors, including the competitiveness of the election. But a lot of the states that experienced problems on June 2nd in particular, such as Maryland, did see significant decreases in turnout. So, you know, again, it's difficult to know what the scale of these problems is in each state. So maybe some states, this really did depress turnout because people were not able to vote. And maybe in other states like Kentucky, it wasn't as big of a factor. But yeah, it's just a lot of anecdata, unfortunately.
When it comes to in-person voting during the primaries, we've heard from some critics claims of voter suppression in cities with large Black populations like Atlanta and Milwaukee. There was some concern about Louisville. Those are places where we've seen polling locations consolidated. Voters had to wait in very long lines for hours in Atlanta. Outside of Atlanta, we saw people waiting for 3 hours or more. We saw something similar in Milwaukee. What's going on here? Is it just that local elections officials are not making up for the fact that polling workers are dropping out and they're not putting in the hard work to keep polling locations open? Or is there something more sinister going on here?
I think a couple things. One is that some of these decisions predate COVID and were decided not within the context of a pandemic where people would be trying to vote by mail and maybe not able to, wanting to vote in person, having to spread out, having poll workers drop out, all these problems that maybe we weren't anticipating. And I just think it's important to note that even if there isn't anything sinister going on and it's just ineptitude, the result is still people not being able to vote, which is a problem, whether it was intentional or not. So that's something we need to address, especially as we head into the general election. I think that it's interesting that one of the problems with trying to expand mail-in voting is a really practical one, which is literally just like having enough paper to print the ballots on, having machines that cut open the envelopes and pull the ballots out to make it easier and faster to make ballots counted. These are really practical things that are difficult to actually achieve. You have to have money. You have to buy equipment, you have to hire people to work and sort through this stuff. And it's something that nobody really anticipated until, you know, March.
Yeah, Kaylee, I totally agree. You know, I think that the hangup maybe comes on when people hear the term voter suppression, they assume that someone is suppressing those votes. But I don't think that necessarily has to be true, or the pandemic can be suppressing votes. You know, the people who weren't able to vote because of the long lines or because they didn't get their ballot, you know, I think their votes were still suppressed, and that is a problem. But there is not evidence that there is something sinister going on. As Galen said, you know, I think that election officials are trying to do the best they can under the circumstances of the pandemic. There's clearly a problem in the fact that urban areas in particular are getting hit hard by polling consolidations, and that tends to be where voters of color, Democrats live, and you know, that leads to a lot of these calls of voter suppression. But you know, I don't think that these areas are being specifically targeted. It's just a question of resources and things like that. I also think it's important to distinguish, you know, there are decisions made by statewide election officials, like in Kentucky consolidating down to one polling place per location. But then, yeah, on the local level, there are a lot of things going in. It's not that they're even not trying as hard as they could be, as you put it, Galen. It's just that they don't have the resources, and some places might be hit more heavily by COVID-19 than others, and therefore it's harder to find poll workers for them. Other places might just be understaffed or underfunded relative to other places. I think there's a wealth disparity there, you know, some urban versus suburban precincts. So, you know, these are all problems, but, you know, I don't think there's anything sinister going on.
Yeah, I think it's also worth noting that a lot of the problems we're seeing are things that voter access advocates have been pushing for. So recommending that every state have online voter registration available, for example. But some of these things are not anything that anyone was pushing for beforehand, like expanded mail-in voting. There wasn't a lot of people that were like, we really need to increase mail-in voting, because we didn't anticipate that there was going to be any reason why everybody would want to mail in their ballots. And so there's just things that couldn't have been anticipated, and we're really struggling with a new challenge.
So looking ahead to the fall, clearly there have been some challenges this spring. Is there any reason to expect that things will go better? Are we seeing secretaries of state across the country or municipalities, local elections officials taking steps now to make sure that people can vote if they want to in the fall?
I know that there are steps being taken. I know there's meetings happening at the state level in many states. They're calling in experts asking, what can we do? How do we do this? Trying to cobble together funding. I think that without the resources, it's going to be really hard to imagine this going any better in November. It's just, as Nathaniel mentioned, it takes resources to increase the people, increase the equipment, just to get everything ready. And yeah, at this point, it's like, I don't want to be pessimistic, but it's really hard to imagine everything going tickety-boo in November.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't bet on things going smoothly exactly, but I do think that there are two reasons to be optimistic. One is that for most states, it will be the second time they've held an election during the pandemic, because these primaries are kind of a trial run. And obviously it is a huge problem that if people are disenfranchised in any election, but I think that in a general election, it is more of a problem, as a lot of primaries aren't competitive, or it's a lower turnout election anyway. And then the second thing is that there's just more time to prepare. So I know that some states, including, for example, my home state of Massachusetts, which is expanding or planning to expand mail voting, states just have time to prepare. So they're passing laws to expand mail voting. They are giving those laws, like handing those laws off to election officials and local officials with plenty of time so that they know that they have, you know, how they have to do this and make these adaptations. So states, especially like Wisconsin, which held its election in early April, which was just 3 weeks into the pandemic, had no time to prepare for the primary. So you know, hopefully that won't be true for November, because there are many months to prepare. That said, I think there probably are going to be some states that either through political gridlock or just kind of sticking their head in the sands aren't going to take the necessary precautions. And that's going to be a problem.
And just wrapping up here, one thing that we've seen during these primaries is that when people vote by mail, it oftentimes takes longer to get results. And so we did have primary elections this week on Tuesday. We are still waiting for many of the results of those elections because so many people did vote by mail. But I don't want to disband this podcast without at least asking what results we do know and whether or not we have an answer to the question in the Democratic Party about whether the progressives would be successful in New York or Kentucky.
Yeah, so Galen, I think your point about it taking a long time to count the ballots in November is such an important one. And I want to emphasize to people that because of the increase in mail voting, basically every state, I think, that has voted during the pandemic in its primaries had a majority of its votes be cast by mail. It's going to take time to count the votes. We might not know who wins the presidency on election night itself, which would be a change from years past. In addition, election results as they stand on that night are going to change. The number of precincts reporting is kind of an outdated figure in the world of mail voting, because the precincts are in-person precincts, and you could have 100% of in-person precincts reporting, but you could still have thousands upon thousands of mail votes left to count. So it'll be really interesting to see how states handle this, especially if someone like President Trump decides to claim victory based on early returns. You already saw in 2018, he claimed that there was voter fraud going on in Arizona because the votes kept on counting and Democrats kept on gaining. So that'll be interesting. But one solution that some states might take, which is one of the things that Kentucky did this week in the primaries, is that they might just not release results until, say, a week out. So several counties in Kentucky, including the ones with the most voters, where Louisville and Lexington are, aren't releasing their results for the June 23rd primary until June 30th. So we basically don't know who is winning in Kentucky. That U.S. Senate primary between Charles Booker, the progressive endorsed candidate, and Amy McGrath, the Washington Democratic establishment endorsed candidate, it looks close right now based on returns in some small counties, but like, I think there are only about 50,000 votes counted there, and it could be as many as 600,000 that get cast in that race. So we don't really know. You know, the Lexington and Louisville returns will obviously be huge there. In New York, there's actually a law that says that absentee ballots can't be counted until a week after the election. And I think that's because absentee ballots are allowed to trickle in late as long as the postmark date is by election day. So they just count them kind of all at once at the end. And as a result, we know the results of in-person voting in New York, but not of absentee voting. So again, the results are still subject to change. We do know that Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez won her primary quite handily. She was being taken on by a pro-business Democrat. We also know that it looks like the progressive challenger in New York's 16th congressional district, Jamal Bowman, who took on Representative Elliot Engel, it looks like he's going to win. He's claimed claimed victory, but the race hasn't been called. So, you know, we should probably wait to see what the final outcome is there. And then there are also several close primaries. For example, in New York's 12th congressional district, Carolyn Maloney is a pretty establishment incumbent who is in a close race right now. Absentee ballots will decide that. And there are also several other outstanding primaries in, for example, the 15th district and the 17th district, which are two open seats where progressives are going up against more moderate and even conservative Democratic candidates.
All right. So like we should expect on Election Day this fall, we're just going to have to be patient in terms of forming our narratives about what happened in New York and Kentucky on Election Day. So thank you for that rundown, Nathaniel. But I think that's it for now. And Kaylee, I want to mention you're, well, relatively new to the 538 team. So welcome to 538. This is your first time on the 538 Politics podcast. It's great to have you. And, you know, you're obviously tracking politics and tech, and a big part of tech in politics this year is going to be how people vote. I'm just curious, what kinds of things are you looking at exploring as we head into the fall?
Right. So one of the things that I was interested in even before the pandemic hit, although I think it's kind of even more important now, is the kind of voting technology that is used, which is a whole vast variety of different types of machines, some of which election security experts say are fine, and others they say are a terrible idea and we shouldn't be using, but we still use in certain states and jurisdictions. And so that sort of patchwork of election tech can cause problems at the best of times. And I'm curious whether the added pressure of a pandemic will make those problems even more apparent. So I'm interested in looking at that. I've been very sort of diverted to focusing on COVID for the last couple months, but I'm eager to get back into focusing on the election.
Yeah, and it seems like, in fact, Atlanta, well, Georgia in general, had some of those problems, right, where they switched voting machines and there was a total meltdown where all of the machines were broken or the people who were running them didn't have the correct training and couldn't work them. And so people were just waiting forever. And it was more because of the machines than anything about COVID.
Exactly. Those machines, if there's any kind of hiccup, they can cause really long lines. And sometimes they don't always have the right redundancies in place to make up for that if a machine isn't working or something goes wrong. And it's especially troublesome if they're using those machines for the first time. You know, typically, like, election officials will want to get new technology in a year when they have maybe a local election or maybe a midterm where voter turnout is a little lower so they can work out the kinks. Having it in 2020 is just asking for trouble, unfortunately.
All right. Well, I look forward to hearing more reporting from you on how our elections administration is going. And of course, thank you, Nathaniel, for joining us today as well.
Thanks, Galen.
Thank you.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the virtual control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store. Actually, do it. Go give us a rating. Or you can tell someone about the show. That's always great, too. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.